This is Points North on Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Peter Payette. And a disclaimer to start our show this week. Usually, in this line of work, you try not to be the news or make the news. But this week, we departed from that general guideline. How else could we find out what Asian carp tastes like, except by feeding it to people? You might recall Asian carp are an invasive fish, now pretty common in the Mississippi River. Everyone wants to keep them out of the Great Lakes. One strategy being employed is to get people to eat them. Later in the hour, we'll hear why this might not be such a good idea. But first, is Asian carp any good to eat? What does it taste like? Well, turns out Asian carp doesn't taste like much at all.
This fish will take on a lot of different flavors because it's got a very mild taste to it. It's not real strong at all, so it'll actually pick up flavors of other things.
Bob Rodriguez teaches at the Great Lakes Culinary Institute. He says it makes sense people are making hot dogs out of this fish.
So if they want it to taste like hot dogs, it'll taste like hot dogs. They could probably make it taste like bratwurst or bologna or whatever, you know, they want. I made this one taste like andouille. And this one has a little bit of orange rind in it with some pieces of coriander and fennel. So you can make it taste however you want, I think. I think it's a really good fish for things like this because it's not real strong.
We're at the Culinary Institute in Traverse City. Bob is standing over a few platters of appetizers he's made with Asian carp from the Mississippi River. He's one of five chefs we gave some fish to see what they could do with it.
Well, what I've got here is I took the Asian carp, and I don't really think it's a carp at all. I did a lot of research on it and reading and watching of YouTube. They have a lot of things on YouTube about it, especially with the Louisiana State University, and they have, it actually looks more like a salmon. It's got the mouth of a salmon, doesn't have the mouth of a carp. Carp's a bottom feeder. So a carp picks up all that sludge on the bottom. This fish is very clean, high in protein, low in fat. It has a very, very clean finish and taste. I saved some of these. This is the biggest pain about this fish. If you look at these things, these Y bones that come out of there. Now I was able to pull these out because I smoked a couple of them, of the fillets. And I made a pate right here, and I have pieces of the whole fish right there. So this has all been smoked. On here, I'm going to put a Cajun-style sausage I made. And on this one, I have a sausage made with a hint of orange rind, toasted coriander, and toasted fennel. So these will be their three appetizers.
So it's interesting that you bring up this saying they're clean, because that's my understanding. One of the big misconceptions when people hear carp, they think of a bottom feeder.
Absolutely, that's what they think of. And if you would look at them and the way they feed, they actually had films of them underwater. They're not on the bottom at all. But they're very, very firm flesh. The protein held up real well on the sausage. I was really impressed with that. At first time I made it, I didn't use any fat at all, so it was a little dry and crumbly, which what it tends to be like when you're low in fat. So I added a little bit of pork fat first the last time we were going to do this, and that turned out well. And I think the hydrogen oil, the non-hydrogenated fat that I used, worked out really well, better. I think it worked out better because you can taste the carp in there. I don't even like calling it carp. You can taste the fish in there, and it does not have a heavy taste. That's what people don't like about carp. The real carp, like that you find here in this lake, is that they're bottom feeders and they're very strong. And what they do is they usually brine them and smoke them because the smoke helps hide all that strong taste. I smoked this one with a very light smoke. I used fruit wood, and I only kept it in there for maybe 45 minutes to an hour. That's it, at about 180 degrees, so I wouldn't overcook the proteins.
The other chefs we lined up are Eric Colden from Red Ginger in Traverse City, Eric Patterson and Jen Blakesley from The Cook's House in Traverse City, and Michael Peterson from Lulu's in Bel Air and Siren Hall in Elk Rapids. Everyone's using bits of fish for a sausage or a cake or in a salad. The closest thing to a fillet being served are little strips of fish wound in a pinwheel. That's because there's so many bones in this animal. One course was served raw. The chefs from The Cook's House did a tartare, that's diced raw meat. Eric Patterson explained it to the group when it was served.
We went with the tartare because the texture is that salmon, tuna kind of, you know, lobstery texture that holds up well if you don't cook it. It's so light that I'm afraid cooking it too much would actually lose a lot of flavor. I mean, it's like whitefish type light. So anyway, a little tartar, a little bit of ginger, miso, some red chili paste. What else did we put in there? Chives,
lime.
Some lime,
cilantro,
and then the mung bean sprouts are just on top. A little bit of oil and some vinegar just to give it a little crunch. Because otherwise, texture wise, I think it'd be a little icky. But so there you go. It's one of my favorite words.
It looks good.
It should be good. Actually, you guys should probably... Well, I'll get you some spoons, because we'll need some spoons for the broth there. The broth is cold. We debated whether we should have the broth hot or cold. I thought hot would be cool to have the two different textures there, but I was afraid it would cook it too much, so we went cold. Maybe the next time we try it, which probably never, but we would do hot.
Once they take over the bay, you can do it all you want. Right?
Yeah, I mean, it's a beautiful meat. It's a hell of a texture. I think cooking it, you got to be very gentle. To get those bones out, if you want to serve it as a fillet, it's going to have to be cooked. And then, all in a minute, basically, the cooks will have to pull those bones, because the bones come out pretty easily once it's cooked. I went through about 3 pounds trying to figure out how to fillet and just gave up. So then what we did is we took one of the fillets and just baked it whole in the oven,
and
so that
the meat off just, and it was really nice and
yeah.
Light.
So once we pulled all the meat off, you kind of see this bone structure in this thing. And I mean, there are bones going through the center of the meat, you know. A pike has got that kind of Y bone. So it's got that Y bone thing, but it's also got these bones just in the most bizarre places.
Everyone eating the meal found the carp mild or even neutral. Patty Lanoue Stearns lives in Leelanau County, and she writes about food. She says she prefers a mild fish.
We have our white fish here. It was on a par with that, I would say.
That's what a few people in the kitchen compared it to white fish.
Absolutely, and maybe not quite as sweet. I would say there's a little bit of that lacking, the sweetness. And they said it was harder to work with. But as we were just talking about with the chefs, it's a matter of education. It's a matter of picking bones out. We need to figure out how to pick out bones, not to be crazy about what's on our plate, and get, you know, take a look at what we're eating again.
The other problem is the brand. As we heard earlier, carp is a misnomer because when it comes to the taste of the fish, Asian carp are not bottom feeders. Eric Colden from Red Ginger says it needs a new name.
You know, everybody hears silverfin. I read somewhere where it said Kentucky tuna. Which I kind of thought was pretty ridiculous. But, I think silverfin or silverfish, something along those lines. Maybe, I don't know if you can put, like, a name like the Illinois River, you know, like that kind of name into the silverfin. So Illinois silverfin or something like that. I don't know if you can market it regionally, you know. But...
I couldn't see Red Ginger serving Kentucky tuna.
That wouldn't fly. That would, I don't think that'd fly too much, you know. But everybody likes their tuna, everybody likes their salmon, everybody likes their hamachi. But people are open, I think, and I think that they would give it a try. I know that the flavors that I tasted here today really kind of make it, you know, plausible.
Yeah, I mean, the food was phenomenal, but then I think, well, maybe it'd be better if you gave them a piece of tuna or a salmon or something like that.
Well, it's tough, too, because if you have a fish that doesn't have a lot of flavor, then you're adding flavor to it, you know, through some kind of ingredient. But with some of these other fish, like tuna and hamachi and those, the flavor of the fish speaks for itself, and therefore you want to keep it simple. I know that with my dish, there was a lot of ingredients I know that if it was a different fish, like a hamachi, I would keep it very simple. Maybe three ingredients, including salt.
How many ingredients did you have here?
I think close to 10. So, and that doesn't include the sauce, the nok cham, which is probably another 7. So.
Now, if any of these chefs put Asian carp on their menu, my bet is Michael Peterson at Siren Hall. His restaurant touts itself as a place to get fresh local seafood. And Michael says the Mississippi River is reasonably local.
It's not being flown in. It's not taken out of the ocean. It's 1-2 days old. Why would we not all want that, you know? So, you know, yes, we love our whitefish up here, and we love our lake trout and, you know, our perch and all that. But we're already depleting that up in the north, you know. Perch has gone up in price. Whitefish is going up in price. Everything is. So, you know, if I could figure out a way, which, you know, I'll think about it, you know. I have a seafood restaurant. Why wouldn't I try to, you know, make it happen, I guess? And I'm not sure I'll be able to, but I don't. You know, tonight, everybody's issues were with the bones. So, well, let's talk about that, you know, and maybe get people to be okay with it. I don't know. You know, that's maybe we'll end up making fish cakes out of it. I don't know. But I would love to figure out a way to serve, make it a staple plate, you know, make it a focus on the entree plate. That would be nice, you know.
Yeah, somebody pointed out that there's a lot of unusual sea creatures. We figure out how to get the meat out of skates,
yeah,
and you know, all sorts of things.
Even lobster. Lobster 200 years ago was garbage food. I mean, and they did the same process with lobster. You know, it was so abundant back then, and now it's a delicacy, and it's, you know, $15 a pound. And lobster's hard to eat, you know. So it's the same thing, and maybe it'll just take time. And, you know, if it becomes a fish that is in our back door, literally, then we're going to have to come up with something for it. So, you know, maybe it's just a matter of time.
And that was our Asian carp dinner, thanks to the chefs that made that happen. The last voice you heard there was Michael Peterson. We also had help from Bob Rodriguez, Eric Colden, Eric Patterson, and Jen Blakesley, thanks to the folks at the Great Lakes Culinary Institute at Northwestern Michigan College for hosting that. You can see some video footage of what went on Tuesday night at our Facebook page, Interlochen Public Radio. So we're talking about Asian carp this morning on Points North. Are they a problem or an opportunity? Could we actually reduce the threat of the fish getting into the Great Lakes by eating the carp? Will people eat carp? Apparently, they do. They're harvesting millions of pounds of the fish from the Mississippi and Illinois rivers. And I'm joined now by Dirk Fusick. He runs Dirk's Fish and Gourmet Shop in Chicago. We got a lot of the fish from him for our experiment. Good morning, Dirk.
Hey, good morning, Peter. How are you doing today?
Good. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
And if anyone wants to join in this conversation with a question or a comment, they could do so at 800-681-5929. That's 800-681-5929. So other than radio stations, Dirk, how's the demand for Asian carp?
Well, we've been using it at the store here probably for about 3 years now, and we do a weekly demo on Saturdays and give away free samples, et cetera. And so that's when I kind of got interested in the carp. I mean, I've been interested in carp. I'm a fisherman. I've caught many a carp in my day, and most of the carp that I'm familiar with are the common carp that are the muddy, bottom-feeding type carp that most people look down upon. Now, Asian carp is, of course, expanding its range everywhere, and they're worried about it getting into the Great Lakes, which ultimately I believe will happen anyway. These fish tend to be plankton feeders, so they're not as muddy of a flavor to them. They actually have a very nice flavor to them, which is mild, which in the world of fish, being in the fish biz here, people are always looking for mild fish that don't taste like fish, and actually carp kind of fits that bill. So I found that a lot of people are reluctant to buy it, or they have been in the beginning anyway here, and then if you give them free samples, though, that's a good way to get around the reluctance of paying for it.
And do you sell it as Asian carp, or do you have a fancy name?
No, we sell it as Asian carp. I don't believe in changing names. We sell, actually, Patagonian toothfish, which most people know as Chilean sea bass. So I think it should be sold as what it is, because you just, you know, trying to pull the wool over someone's eyes on something like that just doesn't make sense. Sell it for what it is and market it for the creature that it is. And if they like it as carp, then that's a great thing. You know, if they like it as Kentucky bass or Shanghai bass or Kentucky tuna, I heard, you know. So some of those are just, you can make up names, but it's not going to cover it. It's not going to make it taste better.
you can call it whatever you want.
Yeah, exactly. But I found that, again, it's the bone issue is the big thing for us. I mean, I've bought in the whole fish, tried filleting it. We fillet all our fish here. We get at the store salmon, tuna, halibuts, et cetera. And I can pull the bones out of most fish. The closest fish to carp that I've dealt with is a shad from the East Coast. And shad has, like, if you fillet a shad, there's about 87 bones on each side of the fish. But they're long, skinny bones, and you can actually pull them out. Trouble with carp is they have a Y-shaped bone, and so when you try to pull part of it out, the other part breaks off. And they're really adhesive to the flesh, so they're hard to, they just don't, they're like glued in. They just do not want to come out, and even if you try to do them one by one, and they have bones in places near the head and the tail that other fish don't really have. So it's pretty frustrating. I've tried to get a nice piece out of there, and probably the biggest piece out of a carp I've gotten is maybe 3 or 4 ounces, and you just can't get even that out of every fish. So the best thing to do, we found, is to grind it, and we double grind it, and I've had pretty good luck with that.
And so are you mainly selling a produced product like a sausage or a cake that you've made, or are you mainly selling fillets by the pound?
We basically sell a ground product because I'm going to give it to the customer, leave it out of here as boneless as possible, because once you get bones in it, that's going to deter them from trying it. I mean, people that are amenable, they're giving it a shot, don't want to have to deal with bones, and so that's one less thing. I mean, literally, we grind it twice, and our grinder doesn't grind the bones in so much as a lot of the bones get pushed up against the grinding plate, and so you have to stop the grinder about every 10 pounds or so and kind of take out the bone dam that's in there, and then we grind it again after I season it, usually for burgers. Burgers tend to be the best thing. People like grilling. I found one of my favorite things to do is a cedar plank. We use cedar planks a lot, so you soak a cedar plank for a couple hours, and you take these burgers and put them on a cedar plank and put them on the grill, close the lid, give it like 5 minutes, go back, flip them over once, give them another 5 minutes, and they come out great. And we did a tomato jalapeno chutney that was very popular. We were at the Taste of Chicago last year working with the DNR and the Corps of Engineers trying to, you know, promote the eating of carp. And we were pretty successful as far as getting, we had a lot of press for it. I mean, people call me from all over the country. Someone called me yesterday from Vegas, as a matter of fact, asking about it. It was kind of weird. But we gave away 800 burgers in about 2 hours. And people were willing to try them. Some people walked away until they found out they were free, and then they turned around and came back and tried one. And, you know, we had pretty good success with it, actually. So we're going back again this year and probably doing it again. And a couple other of our events that we do during the summer here, where you go to the Green City Barbecue, is a annual event that a lot of chefs attend and cook local products at. And I think that's, again, one of the most local things we can get is some of this carp and, you know, keep the focus going on it.
So you're working pretty hard to market this and bring attention to it.
I am. It's not really, it's not a high profit item because, you know, it doesn't cost very much and you don't make a lot of money on it. And it's not really why I'm doing it. It's just, again, it's gives you a little buzz, which is good. You know, people are interested, and I want people to know that it's a good eating fish. In other parts of the world, it's very popular. It's just that here in the United States, we just have a kind of a phobia against carp, but we do eat regular carp. This is Passover right here this week, and we're grinding a lot of fish for gefilte fish, and that's one of the ingredients in many people's recipe is carp and buffalo, and they're the same type of fish, except they are the bottom-feeding type, so they tend to have a little more flavor. But again, you're grinding it, you're mixing with other fish, onions, matzo meal, et cetera, so it tends to take some of the, you know, muddier flavor away. But I think Asian carp is a great, clean-tasting fish, actually, and it amends itself to many things. It just got to get past the bones.
Do you find in the customer's mind that the socially conscious element works backward? I mean, I know there are a number of groups putting out little guides about fish you shouldn't eat because we're depleting them in the where the stocks are. Does it also work the other direction, where people want to eat this fish because they know about the problems it's causing in the Mississippi River Basin and the threat to the Great Lakes?
Well, we're a sustainable fish store, so everything we do here is sustainable. I don't carry unsustainable items, bluefin tuna, unagi eel, orange roughy, things of that sort. So people do come here looking for sustainable product, and it is kind of a reverse in that this item we do want people to eat and try to overfish because of all the problems they're going to cause. And truly, I do believe they're going to get in the Great Lakes, and then that, you know, is a kind of a issue that remains to be seen how it's going to affect it all. you know, we recover from a lot of invasive species that have been introduced. One I always laugh about in the lakes here is, you know, salmon. We introduce salmon to the Great Lakes, and that's a, you know, big commercial, not commercial, but recreational charter business, millions of dollars a year. So it's okay to introduce. That's an okay species. You know, it's like whether it's a flower or a weed. That's always my analogy. It's like, you know, some people like a big purple thistle because it's beautiful, and other people think it's thorny and in the way, so they get rid of it. So it's kind of your perception of what you personally like. And I think carp is something that really needs to be promoted. There's many uses for this carp, and I don't ever think we can actually overfish it. I mean, from what I've heard and read and studied about it, it's just, it's a very prolific fish, and it's very versatile. It can get into almost all kinds of rivers and streams, and once it's in there, it's going to be hard to get out. And they're trying to get it across the border into, like Chinese, for instance, the Asian people like this carp, and it's a fish that Canada's having problems with. They're actually trying to ban it at the border because they're worried about that getting into their systems also. And I had in Dayton, Ohio, I sent some fish over to one of the radio stations there. They did something a couple months ago, and they've actually found traces of carp, you know, in the river there, which leads right into Lake Erie. So, you know, that's, it's just inevitable that it'll be here. So we need to do our best to try to eliminate it, which we won't do, but at least we can put a dent in it. And besides that fact, I mean, it's a protein source that's, I don't want to say it's inexhaustible, but it's a protein source that could really utilize. A lot of fish are harvested for fish meal, sardines, menhaden, things of that sort, and that actually fishes down the food base in the ocean, which affects just about everything. So if we could take this fish, and it's a little less oily than some of those fish, but on the other hand, you have an almost endless supply, so you can kind of make up for it in quantity, but you can take this fish and grind it as fish meal. And fish meal is in almost all animal feed, you know, cows, pigs, sheep, chickens, etc., and even in aquaculture for fish. So you could use this fish as a base and add, you know, whatever nutrients and et cetera you needed to, if you were a particular animal that you were raising, and that would be a great out for it. You also have the fishermen catching it. You employ them. You have people processing the fish, people distributing the fish, ends up down to retailers like us selling the fish. So, I mean, there's a huge chain of effect that could really be beneficial to very many people, for low-income people, food banks, things like that. This would be a great addition to what they have also. So, I mean, there's a lot of potential for this fish.
And going back, you brought up Canada, and I was over in Toronto where there, a lot of unprocessed carp, Asian carp, is sold at these Asian fish markets. They would prefer to purchase it alive, which is not legal. But I saw in almost all of these big head carp set out, and it wasn't even filleted. It was cut up sort of a, like a steak or a big hunk of the midsection. But you don't have much demand from people that want to deal with the fish themselves?
Not really. Again, it comes to the, well, we put whole fish on the counter, so we have beautiful red snappers, and you have striped bass and whitefish and things. And, you know, as far as fish go, they're pretty. You know, carp you put out, and they're not pretty. they kind of have an odd look to them, and their eyes down lower than the other fish. And they're usually pretty large, kind of gray looking, not very, you know, appetizing that way. But truly, once you fillet them, I mean, once you steak them, that's originally how I started playing around with it as a steak because of the bone problem. And I find if you actually grill steaks, they, you kind of char the skin peels off, and the meat flakes off the bone. But inevitably, I always found, you know, you get bones in it. So it just came to the point of doing the grinding as the easiest and most expeditious way to, you know, have it consumer-friendly.
Now, at one point, you were going to send us some fish, but your supplier brought you common carp. Do you sell much common carp?
Not during the year. During the gefilte fish season now, that's one of the ingredients for a typical world gefilte fish, you know, which is a ground fish recipe during the Jewish holidays here, and we do quite a bit of that. I caught 100 pounds of that stuff yesterday, you know, so. And again, it's a, if you cut a big head or silver carp, the flesh is white or light in there. If you do the common carp, the original German carp, they are a darker fleshed fish, definitely. So, I mean, there's a big difference night and day between the color of the fillets. Not that that makes a big difference, because we sell bluefish and mackerel, which are dark fillets, as opposed to whitefish or walleye, which are light fillets. But flavor-wise, you find that common carp definitely has a stronger flavor.
And can you ultimately move that much fish if it's always in a cake or a sausage, something that where it has to be ground?
You know, it's in my retail business here, it's people will buy it, and it's kind of a novelty at this point in time, and people do come back asking for it. It seems to be more popular summertime grilling here and things of that sort. I told you we've made a few sausages, and we're going to play around with trying to increase that this year and do some different flavors and sausages. And I don't know that, for me, that we'll sell. I mean, we get about 1,000 customers a week, so if 1,000 customers buy, you know, or 500 customers buy carp, that's good. But I think it really needs to get, you know, into like a processing. Somebody really needs to, you know, have a plan and have a plan and really promote this and, you know, get into supermarkets, you know, get it packaged and frozen would be a good way to go. The person that called me yesterday from Vegas was interested in something like that. And for me, I'm just too small really at this point in time to, you know, really kind of take on that challenge. But to me, it's more of just making people aware of it and, you know, just trying to get more and more people to try it. And I figure from there, that's if people are aware of it and they've got it in their mouth once, it gives it more of a reality as to what it is.
I read someone's trying to develop a hot dog.
Yeah, I mean, we do sausages, but sausage is a hot dog, basically. So, and so we're going to play around with some flavors, Cajun flavor, Italian, et cetera. And they do that with all kinds of processed meats. So carp would be a perfect for that. Fish is lean, low-fat protein, so it's ideal over some of the ingredients I've read in some hot dogs.
And do you find other retailers are as interested as you are in playing around with this?
Doesn't seem like it. I mean, some of the chefs want to play with it. I know there's a couple people in town here that play around with it occasionally and things like that. But in a higher-end restaurant, as one of your chefs was mentioning too, you know, it's not exactly what they're looking for. If you're carrying a local fish and a sustainable fish, I think that is part of the interest in it. And a lot of people are concerned with the environment, so they would taste this at least once and try it. But I don't know if it would be something on a menu at this point in time that people would, you know, readily go for, that you could sell a lot of. That's part of the problem with dealing with the carp, is that that's the retail or the consumer eating it in the end is a help, but I don't think they can eat enough of it, honestly, at least at this point in time, that they could make a big dent in the population. That's why I think it needs to get on the more industrial scale, the fish meal type of thing, or, you know, processing and doing it for food banks, something like that would be a better way to go to move a lot of carp.
And you're saying from a taste bud perspective, the main attraction, the main quality it has that's good is that people don't like fishy fish.
Correct. It is not a fishy fish, and it's amenable to, you know, adding flavors to it. I know one of the gentlemen there on your last tasting there did the tartare, I guess, with a lot of ingredients in it, which is fine. But for me on the tartare, the only issue I would have with that, to me, by grinding it, you end up with a softer texture to it, and I kind of like a little coarser tartare. You see these at Dice, but again, with this fish, it just doesn't leave you much options for that.
Well, I would think there'd be a lot of opportunity. I grew up on Van de Kamp's fish sticks, and I would think this would work perfectly for something like that.
Oh, 100%. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, one of the bigger, you know, hamburger joints could, you know, could promote this, as opposed to a pollock is what's generally used in fish sandwiches, things like that. And they make surimi, which surimi is pollock that's been filleted and ground and reformed, and they add crab meat to it, you know, make that imitation crab they put in sushi, like California rolls. You can also get surimi in all different shapes. It's fish cakes you get in, you know, Korean, you know, soups and Japanese soups and things of that sort. So there's a lot of room for using carp the same way. I mean, we can reform it anyway. They add sometimes potatoes to it, things of that sort to make the cakes, but it would work perfectly for that.
And just one last question, and we'll let you go. It's sort of a self-correction here. At the end of our dinner event there, Michael Peterson was saying some of the fish that we get locally out of the Great Lakes, he has concerns about perch and whitefish. You're saying at your shop you're quite careful with this. Which Great Lakes fish, if any, are you unwilling to carry because of concerns about their population?
Well, basically, most of the Great Lakes fish, I believe, are any fish in the United States I found, I'm going to say 99% of them are really well managed. I mean, that's why I try to get a lot of fish out of the United States. Their government really watches things. I think in the Great Lakes, a lot of the perch is a fast-growing fish, so they actually are, you know, monitored well, and, you know, fishermen have to catch their quotas, and there's times of the year you can't get it for that reason. Same applies to whitefish and to walleye. Smelts are something that I get mostly out of Canada, for instance. I grew up here in Illinois myself, and we used to go fishing for smelts quite often, and now people go fishing for smelts, and whereas we used to catch buckets of them, they maybe get, you know, a couple pounds these days. So there are things that have changed in the lakes, but I think a lot of it is not necessarily overfishing per se, is the changing of the ecology of the lake with the introduction of things like gobies, zebra mussels, quagga mussels. Those type of things are invasive species that really filter the water. They change the whole consistency and the whole, you know, food chain of the lake. I mean, those are more problems, I believe, than actually, you know, us overfishing the fish. I think fish is pretty well monitored as far as the Great Lakes go.
All right. Well, Dirk, nice to talk to you.
All right. Well, I appreciate talking to you guys. I, you know, hope you have more fun with your carp. And, you know, if we all keep mentioning it and just, you know, giving it a taste here and there and just try to educate more people, I think that's the way to go.
All right. Have a good one.
Okay. Thanks, Peter. Bye-bye.
Dirk Fusick runs Dirk's Fish and Gourmet Shop in Chicago. You're listening to Points North on Interlochen Public Radio. We're talking about the prospect for Asian carp as a seafood delicacy. And it might seem like eating an invasive species is a no-brainer, but that's actually not the case. In fact, my next guest will explain that the decision to develop commercial markets for Asian carp is out of the ordinary. You usually wouldn't do this with an invasive species. Dwayne Chapman is a biologist with the U.S. Geological Survey. He's part of the Asian Carp Working Group, and he was involved in the discussions about whether a commercial harvest of Asian carp would be a good strategy for keeping the fish out of the Great Lakes. And he joins us by phone from his office in Missouri. Good morning, Dwayne.
Good morning.
Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Now, maybe just one quick question on the eating side. I think you told me you've had Asian carp a couple times in the past week or two.
I had them last night. As a matter of fact, it's not uncommon. I haven't had any fish for a while, so I recently was given several fish. I've been eating it a lot. We've actually had it three times in a week, which is unusual for us. But
you just cook it at home?
Yeah, we cook it at home, and it's good fish.
What do you do with it?
Last night we had it smoked. I've also had it this week in a curry, and also we just put it on the grill.
That whole fillet on the grill?
Yeah, that's a common way for us to do it.
And the bones aren't too big a hassle?
Not if your fish are fairly decent size. They come out pretty well. I grew up eating fish, and so I know how to pick bones, but when you have decent-sized fish, the bones aren't that big of a problem.
And let me say, I forgot to say, if any listener wanted to get in on this conversation with a comment or a question, please call us at 800-681-5929, 800-681-5929. So it's sort of counterintuitive that you might not go and try to net these fish and fish them out of the river. Explain the downsides to this strategy.
Right. I don't want people to think that I'm against this strategy because it is a point of contention, and the stakeholders have weighed this very well, I think, and made it using the best wisdom possible. They went ahead and decided that in this case we were going to go the route of actually enhancing harvest if possible. But there are a lot of downsides, so that was a judgment call, and we don't know for sure if it was a good call. It'll be a big experiment, and we won't know the results for at least 10 years, whether it was a good idea or not. But one of the downsides, for example, is bycatch. You do catch in the nets when you're fishing for these fish, paddlefish, which is a fish that we've been trying to enhance. And paddlefish, if you catch them in nets, they will, in the summertime, they will die because they, you know, it's just really, they're not very adapted to sitting in a net. They have to swim all the time or they will drown. And at least during the warmer weather. And as the fish actually get fished down a bit, and one of the things we're seeing now is the size of the fish is being decreased because of commercial fishing, and we're seeing some impacts. And as the nets get smaller and smaller, we're going to probably see more impacts on other native fishes that are not so large. Right now we're not seeing, other than paddlefish, we're not seeing any undesirable bycatch issues. But we're also going to see conflicts between commercial fishers and recreational fishers and boaters because those nets can be put up in the places where, you know, other people would like to fish. Another thing that a downside is that, you know, as we develop these markets, people are going to get their livelihoods wound up in these fish. So that gives us a motivation to actually increase them. There are already people out there, even though there isn't any real shortage of Asian carps, there are people that are lobbying for maximum sustainable yield now. They want to see us manage these fishes for a continued fishery. And I think there are a lot of people who would think that was a really scary proposition. And so it's we consider that a bad idea. So another thing is that we are developing some emerging technologies that will give us some potential to control the fish through other ways. Right now, we don't have any way to control the fish other than harvest. But there are new emerging technologies that might give us a chance to control these without fishing for them. And we won't be able to employ those if people have their livelihoods wrapped up in carp, at least as easily.
So how do you, let me ask, going in then, how do you prevent, I mean, basically you're saying you're creating a stakeholder group that will defend this carp, want it to thrive to some extent in the Mississippi River Basin. So how do you prevent that voice from becoming a strong one? How do you establish this and everyone understands the purpose is to suppress these fish as much as humanly possible?
Well, that's a really good question, and I think maybe that's a question we need to answer better. We don't have a really good plan in place as to what we're going to do, to avoid that potentiality. Who am I to say that it's not, you know, I'm not on one side or the other of this question. I just want people to acknowledge that we do have competing, by going this route, we are creating a competing concern that some people are going to want to grow more carp, and that's going to be a problem. Another thing is that people will move the fish around, and if there becomes too big of a competition for existing carp, either in terms of number of fish or in just places to put your nets, for example, there's a good chance that these people will. There are people out there who would move them into new places and create new fisheries. And even though that would be illegal, it's really, really hard to catch someone with a bucket full of baby fish. So, there's that would be another problem that you might get. And we don't have a good strategy in place at this point to keep those sort of things from happening.
As I was thinking about this, it occurred to me that you probably couldn't find any person out there who would be in favor of these fish getting into the Great Lakes, but when you have commercial fishing operations and there's not enough work, then you might have someone who wouldn't think it was a bad idea for the fish to become established in the Great Lakes.
Right. I think when you say that there's not any one person, there's always one person that believes something.
but they're pretty few and far between in this particular case.
Right. Well, the point is that if you're an invasive species, it doesn't matter if 99.99% of the people hate you. All it takes is one person that really likes you. And so you get that one person, and you've got a problem. And so that is a substantial problem. I do want to say that, if the fish were to become established in the Great Lakes, and I think they could become established in the Great Lakes if they were adequately introduced, that it would be really, really difficult to catch them there. So that I don't know if everyone would understand that, but if a commercial fisherman was to stock these fish into the Great Lakes, there'd be two things going on. He'd be competing; those fish would compete with other fishes for which there are commercial fisheries already, and so there would be he'd have to be competing with. I don't think that it would really work because there's already a pretty good commercial fishery in the Great Lakes, and you're not going to, you'd be exchanging this high-dollar fishery for a low-dollar fishery. That'd be bad. And plus, Asian carps are really difficult to catch in deep water. So, they're much, 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 much easier to catch when they're in shallow water than they are in deep water, and they will live in open, deep water, in which case other places around the world have great troubles catching them. So we could have a lot of fish in the Great Lakes and not be able to catch them at all. So, that would be a big problem.
Let me bring in a caller here from Kalkaska, Don in Kalkaska. You're on Points North.
Yes, hi. One of the things that concerns me about encouraging people to prepare the fish in different ways and saying how great tasting it is and perhaps even changing the name of the fish so that you don't have to name carp related to it, is that it might become so popular that people would want to bring them back and release them in their local lakes and the Great Lakes and all over, and we'd be actually encouraging the spread of them. It seems to me like the commercial venue of grinding them up and using them for animal foods and various other things would avoid that problem.
Okay, thanks for the call. What, Dwayne, was there discussion of limiting the markets and restricting what these could be used for, to, for say, fertilizer or cat food?
No, there really hasn't been. In fact, these other markets, these alternative markets for the fish, there are these other markets, but like fish meal and cat food and that sort of thing, but they're not economically viable by themselves. The another market, for example, is extraction of the omega-3 fatty acids, because they're kind of high in omega-3s. At least the skin and other and certain parts of the body that you wouldn't normally eat would be very high in omega-3s, and so they've got these things. That's another potential market, but none of those markets are a viable market without either subsidies or, you know, the other option is that you can use some of the fish for human consumption and then have these other byproducts of the carp. But, you know, so you have to realize that these other potential products are not commercially viable by themselves.
Well, let's switch to the upsides here. In this case, the stakeholder group, which I assume is mostly made up of representatives of government agencies that are working on this problem, decided to go ahead and do this. Why is it possibly a good idea in the case of Asian carp to have a commercial harvest?
But I want to make it clear that it wasn't just government. There were government people associated with these stakeholders, but there were also people from commercial fishing, aquaculturists. There was a wide variety of stakeholders, including public and private industry, involved in that decision. But it's, you know, again, I think that things were well weighed, and there are, in this case, there are. It does make some sense to market the Asian carp. One thing is, it's, you know, or to harvest them anyway. The only tack right now that we have that's going to give us immediate potential results and help us keep the number of fish down so that they don't successfully invade the Great Lakes is harvest. We didn't have another tool at the time, and we still don't have another tool which would effectively reduce the number of the fish. And again, the undesirable effects of these fishes are directly due to their abundance. If you'd only have a few of them, that wouldn't be a problem. But since we're up to our neck in the darn things, that's what makes them so problematic. So we're able to, through harvest, reduce them, and also reduce them by focusing harvest through subsidies on places where they might be most likely to invade the Great Lakes. So that's really been useful, and it's been successful. We are seeing reduced populations in the zone where they might, where the most of the fish are have access to the Great Lakes.
You're saying it's
another
working.
Thing. What's that?
It's working. The pressure is okay.
Right. Yeah, it's working. We're through subsidies, we're able to control the fish population in localized areas where they're most at risk of getting through to the Great Lakes, and it is definitely working, or at least the existing population seems to show that it is. I mean, the catches are going down in those areas. Another thing is that with the carp, and we do have some models that seem, you know, of harvest models that seem to say that we can control the population. Lots of kinds of invasive species, you may be able, you know, you may harvest the heck out of them. Some people make some monies, but there isn't any evidence that you might actually control the fish. And in the case of the carp, there's evidence that, yes, we do have the statistical models that show that with, you know, a reasonable level of effort, that we will have a substantial effect on the population. So there is, you know, a reason to believe that it can be effective. Another thing that's really important that was kind of an issue in most of the places that people could illegally start new populations, are already accessible to the carp anyway because they can just swim there. So it's with the exception of the Great Lakes, that's the big notable exception, and a few reservoirs. Most places that people could introduce these fish to are not going to be places where they could reproduce. And we had that one caller talked about taking them and putting them in their private lakes and all that sort of thing. Well, they probably would never catch them again, but they probably wouldn't reproduce except for in a few cases. So there aren't many places other than the Great Lakes that people could transfer these fish to and start new populations unless they transported them a long ways to the east or west coast and totally out of the basin. Upside to the harvest method is it doesn't necessarily require taxpayer funding unless you want to. There are certain cases which it would, so it can be free or nearly free to the taxpayer, and so you still get, you know, the advantage of control. And it's a boom to some people. And the final one is that these fish do taste good, and they're full of things that are good for you, and they're low in contaminants. They're high in protein. They're full of omega-3s, and they're really low in the food chain. So in a place where some fish would be might even be high enough in contaminants, it might be of concern. Many of those same places, Asian carps, because they feed so low in the food chain, they're not benthic. I mean, they don't live down in the mud, and they grow really fast. Those characteristics make them a fish that doesn't collect many contaminants. And so, you know, it's for one thing, we're not going to probably contaminate a bunch of people by promoting that they eat it. And the other thing is that it's just, something that, you know, we can use to provide a cheap protein source for people who need protein and other good things that are in fish.
Do you have a sense of how large an industry has been created at this point? How many people are working in this? How much infrastructure has been built to
Right now, there are really only two major buyers from that are buying directly from the commercial fishermen. I mean, they go through millions of pounds a year now of fish. One of those places has just, with a subsidy from the state of Illinois, has recently added a whole another processing center. There is another place that is, again, with a subsidy from Illinois, has been able to get a bunch of giant grinders, they're machines that remove the bones, or they essentially squash the fish through a plate, I think is what they do, and the bones stay on one side of the plate, and the meat goes through, so you end up with a jelly that comes out the other end that you can turn into different kinds of products. And those were purchased with an assistance from the state of Illinois as well. Illinois, again, has more carp than any other state, probably. But again, the only two major buyers that are buying, you know, more than several tons, or hundreds of tons a year, are those two in Illinois. There are some other minor buyers that are getting into it and increasing annually the amount of fish that they're buying, but there really are only right at this point those two places, and I don't have a good idea of how many people they employ, but I'm sure it's substantial. And the number of commercial fishermen every year that are working to catch an Asian carp is definitely going up because the number of fish that are being caught are going up. It's not a huge number of people. For example, Ryan Briney's team, he's one of the top commercial fishermen of Asian carps, and he has on his boats with him two or three assistants, every day, and they bring in between them about 4 to 12,000 pounds of fish every time they go out. So that's a lot of fish, and doesn't take many commercial fishermen to provide tons and tons of fish for the market.
And what sense do you have of the markets and how strong they are and whether they're expected to, you know, hold where they are now or grow?
My feeling is that they're going to grow. Whether or not states and, you know, federal government assisted. And really that's what's happened for the most part. With the exception of Illinois, there hasn't been much funding of these different people, the entrepreneurs that are coming in. They're being, but on the plus, on the side of the entrepreneurs, at least the state and federal and the environmental groups are not getting in the way of these people. And I think that's, you know, in many cases, in the harvesting of invasive species has been banned because of the reasons that we discussed. These downsides, just doesn't make sense to allow it. But in the case of the Asian carps, people are letting the entrepreneurs come in and try to make a business out of this, and there's more and more people interested in it all the time. There's been a lot of press. But the market is still pretty low. I mean, there's a sense by some people that these Asian carps, for example, you hear fairly often that they're a delicacy in China. And that's not really true. These fish are good fish, and they are the hot dog of China. They're the cheapest animal protein any way that you can buy. And so it makes it difficult for us to catch them here and send them to China and make money on it. The price to the commercial fishermen is fairly low, and so they have to move a lot of fish to make it worthwhile. It's not, you know, I don't want people to think that you can get into this market and just become rich overnight selling these fish, because it isn't so.
And so, very quickly, so why do you have an expectation for growth?
Because I think, you know, the quality of the fish is good, and I think people will gradually catch on to it, you know, that it's a cheap here in this country. And also, markets are being developed in Europe for these fish as well. That, you know, it is a high quality, you know, fish, and people are coming up with new products, you know, value added type products. It's going to be difficult always to sell this, any kind of fish with bones in it, to North American consumers. But the bones in these fish are fairly large, and if you can eat a if you've got a large fish, and so if you can eat a chicken wing, you know, you can eat one of these fish if you flay it out in the right way, without, right, similar amount of trouble.
Dwayne, thanks for your time this morning. It was nice to talk to you.
All right, thank you.
All right, Dwayne Chapman is a biologist with the U.S. Geological Survey as part of the Asian Carp Working Group. This has been Points North on Interlochen Public Radio. Thanks to Neil Stino and Jack Connors for helping me produce the show. John Wunsch composed and performed our theme. You can find us online at ipr.interlochen.org/pointsnorth. I'm Peter Payette. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.